You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The most interesting research I did was in the British Library, was reading the handwritten memoir and confession by Anthony Blunt, which was extraordinary.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com.
Gareth Rubin is an author and journalist, and today we're talking to him about his latest novel, Liberation Square, set in a Soviet-occupied UK in the 1950s. Thanks to our select band of supporters who are helping us financially for the price of a cup of coffee a month to cover our increasing costs and keep us on the air. They're also the proud owners of a Cold War Conversations coaster. Don't you want one too? Just go to patreon.com/coldwarpod. That's patreon.com/coldwarpod. So, back to Gareth's novel. After a disastrous failure of D-Day, Britain is occupied by Nazi Germany and only rescued by Soviet soldiers arriving from the east and Americans from the west. The two superpowers divide the nation between them, a wall running through London like a scar. Now, if you listen to the end of this podcast, there's a chance to win one of three copies of Liberation Square delivered to your door anywhere in the world. So listen through to the end. We welcome Gareth Rubin to our Cold War conversation. Very aptly, we are in Highgate Cemetery in London, in front of Karl Marx's grave, as handily Gareth lives not too far away. So we thought it would make the ideal Cold War conversations location. Welcome to Cold War Conversations, Gareth.
Thanks very much.
So Karl Marx.
It's interesting to live by him and occasionally to see people who are actually visiting his grave, which I like to, you know, see from time to time, see how he's getting on. And I suppose he's one of those figures who's never going to be out of fashion, in a sense. He's maybe not as fashionable as in the 1970s or 1920s or the 1890s even. But I don't think we're going to see him forgotten, hidden under the sands of time anytime in the next couple of centuries. He's going to keep on inspiring new generations and new sections of society for probably as long as there are people on this planet.
Yeah, no, sure, absolutely. So what could you tell us about Liberation Square, your latest novel, without giving too much away?
Well, it's set in 1952 in the London, which is divided down the middle by a great big wall. And yes, that is directly taken from Berlin, of course. Although I've telescoped the time scale of the division of Berlin and the building of the wall. So Britain, has been invaded successfully by the Nazis after the failure of D-Day. After that, the Soviets, who stayed out of the war, then swept through, Poland and Germany, stabbing Germany in the back with 12 million fresh troops, and swept right into Britain and started creeping up through Britain. They took it slower than they should, and the Americans arrived like cavalry over the hill in the north of England. And Britain is therefore, in my world, divided in two, with London, with the south of England under Soviet a Soviet stooge state, puppet state, with London, as Berlin was, as a little oasis in the middle of the communist zone, and London itself is divided in two, with the north-west sector belonging to the sort of democratic north of United Kingdom, with a road going up from London into the northern part of Britain, the free part. So that's the background. And then in overlaid on top of that is essentially a murder mystery, which in which my main character, Jane, has to investigate the horrendous and shocking death, giving the game away slightly, of her husband's ex-wife, which is linked into the political corruption, which is inherent within kind of most Marxist regimes. And rears its ugly head in the British Marxist regime as well.
And I love the way that you'd used real history to place political figures within that regime. So various members of the Cambridge Five are significant political figures.
They are. The first secretary is Blunt himself, and dotted around you have Kim Philby, Burgess. I real aficionados will notice that Don McLean is never mentioned, because for slightly suspicious reasons he has somehow been sort of airbrushed from history, though all the others kind of pop up in one guise or another, as does Karen Cross, who so obviously people who know a lot about the Cold War and Cold War spying will be aware of, although the average member of British, you know, British population doesn't know him as well. And also, Wynne, who was leader of the Oxford spy ring, who, of course, nowhere near as well known as the Cambridge ring, but were operative. They were operational, fed some, information to the Soviets, but were just not as successful.
Sorry, that was the Oxford ring. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. They've largely been overlooked because they simply weren't as successful. But they were direct parallels to their Cambridge counterparts.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one because you know, it's a question that I have asked, is that if they were so successful in Cambridge, why didn't they recruit in Oxford? And obviously they did, they just didn't get the successes.
No, they were recruited in exactly the same way by exactly the same people, in fact, and operated in the same way, but just, I guess, through luck, the Oxford spies just weren't as well placed as the Cambridge spies. It's partly, of course, the Cambridge spies all helped each other, egged each other on a bit, and perhaps the Oxford spies just weren't as successful as interacting in that way.
No, really interesting, really interesting. So how did you arrive at the idea for the book?
Well, I wrote an article recently for The Observer, which is about how a lot of alt histories are occurring at the moment, popping up, partly inspired by the sudden inversion in the socio-political order we're seeing in Western Europe and in the US at the moment. I was partly inspired by the rise of Corbyn to the leadership of the Labour Party. The Brexit vote happened while I was writing the book, and as did the election of Donald Trump. But the election, the rise of Corbyn made me think about how Marxism is still kind of ingrained within a stratum of British society. How for many years we were really very close to people with strongly communist ideas entering Parliament, gaining footholds even within the cabinet. And of course there have been some communist MPs over the years, not very many, but you know, a spattering of them, and there are still people like Jeremy Corbyn who admire Marx and given his way would probably bring in some sort of Marxist command economy. However successful that would be, you know, that's very questionable.
Yeah. Let's not get too far onto the contemporary politics. And the timeline I found interesting about the D-Day defeat and the Soviets coming, you know, through Poland. How did you sort of arrive at that?
Well, I had to find a way for the Soviets to defeat Nazi Germany in a fairly clean sort of way. I mean, I could have come up with a very complex history, military history of the latter parts of the war, post Kursk, maybe, you know, just, or maybe from some 1950s, just the Soviets gaining more and more military, economic power and slowly kind of rolling through Europe that way. But really, I wanted something fairly clean, to be honest. That could have been, I toyed with the ideas of the Soviets, you know, creating a nuclear bomb in the 1940s, which is not out of the question, and defeating Nazi Germany and the Western powers that way. Probably if the Soviets had created the bomb 18 months before the Americans, then yeah, maybe the Russians would have won the Cold War straight off before it had even begun. But I preferred something which is more plausible, which necessitated less fictionalizing. So I just posited the idea of the Soviets having stayed out of the war from the very beginning, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact having stayed, the Germans then and the Western allies having beaten each other to a standstill, the Soviets having eventually crept across the channel. Sorry, the Nazis having eventually crept across the channel, eventually having just about won the war. And then the Soviets with their fresh troops, with their million odd tanks and their massive military might, then just beating down the overstretched German lines, which is seemed to be fairly clean and really quite plausible.
Yeah. It sounds like you've got quite a detailed knowledge of the Cold War history. Did that help you a lot with the book?
Well, certainly I obviously researched it to an extent. Probably the most interesting research I did was into the lifestyles of the people living behind the Iron Curtain in East Germany, East Berlin. Because when we're at school, or university, you learn mostly about the higher level of affairs. You learn about the Cuban Missile Crisis and you learn about the wall and you learn about the big armies facing each other across the Checkpoint Charlie and across the Iron Curtain. Because I was writing a book primarily about people living under, a Marxist regime, that's the research I had to do. So I watched kind of documentaries and I read books about people, memoirs about people who lived in that state, both Westerners who had gone to live in East Germany, but also from people who'd grown up in that.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Under that system. And it's not very long ago that it existed. It existed in the lifetimes of most people who are going to be listening to this podcast, existed in my lifetime. And I remember speaking to a friend of mine whose mother grew up in East Germany and at one point attempted to escape across the wall when she was 16. And when she was 16, she was caught and she was thrown into prison, and she spent 6 months in prison because of that. It's in many ways kind of extraordinary to those of us who have grown up in the West, and have German friends, and to think that many of them grew up under that system, or their parents grew up under that system. We're in an era where, you know, the last survivors of the Holocaust are nearing the end of their days, and that seems quite far away. The Holocaust, the end of the war, but the fall of the Berlin Wall really is not very long ago at all.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I do the podcast, is to try and capture some of these witness stories before they're lost. And there's a lot out there that are really interesting that have never been published. Mm. I was interested in how you mixed sort of contemporary, well, sort of 1950s British history with that whole Marxist regime, because you had, I was pleased to see you had the Teddy Boys involved in there.
Yes, yeah, that's actually one of my favourite parts of the book, that the interaction between some 1950s British style and society, and on what that would mean living under a sort of Marxist authoritarian regime. So, yes, I like to kind of imagine the, these kind of rebellious youths from the early 1950s living in a totalitarian dictatorship where thought and action is suppressed and oppressed and confined, and people put in boxes very much. Whereas in the 1950s, in reality, was an era when people were kind of really breaking loose from quite a staid history and society in Britain. And that's the era that rock and roll started. It's the era when, sort of gang culture, sort of youth gang culture started. Of course, you know, it existed in the 20s and 30s, but to a much less prominent extent. This was an era when nice middle class boys and girls started getting involved in rebellious dances and music and clothes fashion. And I thought it was fun to kind of interact that with.
It was one of my favourite bits, actually, that it was sort of unexpected, because I've obviously read a lot of East German histories and things like that. And although there was an aspect of youth rebelliousness, that very UK youth rebelliousness, because I think the Teddy Boys was a very UK phenomenon.
Yes, I think so. They were a little bit sort of taking style from French rebellious youth, and also American rebellious youths. But the kind of fashion, they're of course called Teddy Boys because they were rediscovering Edwardian styles, Edwardian fashion, which they were using in a slightly ironic sort of way. But the sort of the swagger which they had was taken partly from French and American youths. One of the things, just to kind of slightly skip ahead, my new book is, my forthcoming book is set, it's not an old history, it's set in Paris just before D-Day. And they had, under the Nazi dictatorship then, the Nazi puppet regime they had then, they had kind of parallels of youths who were into swing dance, and they also wore slightly sort of outsized suits, and they showed their kind of rebelliousness against the fascist Nazi regime they were living under in that way, through music and fashion as well. So it's one way that young people have always shown their individualism.
So I was interested to understand how you write your book. So do you have a clear idea of the plot before you start?
I don't. I'm very bad at that. Some authors write out painstakingly every plot point, virtually page for page. I'm very bad at that. Whenever I've tried really planning a plot, I've just halfway through gone off completely as a tangent, and in fact not even halfway through, a tenth of the way through, and I've just abandoned basically all the notes that I've made, so it's been a bit pointless. So what I do now is generally I just have a starting point. I start generally with an image in my mind, and then just kind of go on from there. I have vague plot points in my mind, but they're so vague I don't bother writing them down even these days.
Right. Sound like the most efficient way of working.
It's really not. It's terribly inefficient, but it's the only way I can do it.
Okay. Well, it certainly worked with this one anyway. The other thing that I did find interesting was Jane, because you write the book from a female point of view. Why did you choose that angle?
Well, I was interested in a character who grows in strength hugely throughout the book. As you mentioned, it's set in the 1950s, and there's this curious interaction between 1950s British sensibilities and Soviet Marxist ideals. Of course, under the Soviets, the role of women, there's quite a lot of female emancipation, and the role of women was centralized and celebrated, and they were seen as stronger individuals than in some previous eras. Obviously, under the Tsarists, it was a very different situation. And in Britain, there was also the great kind of emancipation of women after each war, really. And so I wanted to show an individual who was growing in her place or within the society, as well as within, you know, the plot and the story of the book. And so a female character, and Jane starts off a little bit under the thumb of her husband, partly because he's just so charismatic, partly because it's 1952 and, you know, men were still largely in charge. But then it's suddenly on her to clear his name from a murder charge, which, of course, in those days would have meant execution. And so she has to find her feet and both, you know, within the story and within society. And she becomes a much stronger individual. And I think she's, I hope she's kind of interesting for that.
Yeah, no, I think she is. And I think it makes a change from some of the novels I've read anyway, by coming from that angle. I was going to ask you, how did you do your research into the early Cold War? Is there any other insight you can give me? Did you go to archives or anything like that?
The most interesting research I did was in the British Library. Was reading the handwritten memoir and confession by Anthony Blunt, which was extraordinary. When he died, he left it in the care of a friend of his, who gave it to the British Library on the proviso that it be kept secret for 25 years, until 25 years after Blunt had popped it, and that 25 years was up a few years ago. At which point the British Library revealed it had this extraordinary written confession. So I went along, I applied to read it. 2 hours later, it was brought out to me in this great sort of packet, which I sat there with it on a foam reader, which is designed to stop any kind of damage, just turning over the pages with my own hands. It was extraordinary to read.
Wow, that must have been quite some experience with something that is such an amazing historical document.
It is. It's interesting to read. It's interesting to read partly because I think it's fairly self-delusional, that he blames his treachery, if you want to see it that way. And I'm willing to take both sides on that. I think that the Cambridge Five were doing what they believed was right. It's entirely possible that some of the information they fed to the Soviets during the war, from Bletchley Park, etc., quite possibly hastened the end of the Second World War. Certainly kind of strengthened the Soviets, the Soviet armies, in their battles against the Germans, which I think most of us would recognize is what largely led to the end of the Second World War, at least when it happened. So you could well say they're perfectly justified in helping the Soviets to get, behind the backs of the fairly paranoid British government at the time. What they did after the war is more controversial, you know, whether or not they did lead to the deaths of Western agents. Yeah, it's whether or not they were justified in any way in keeping the two superpowers in a standoff rather than one attacking the other. Well, possibly. But essentially, Anthony Blunt, at the end of his life, was a fairly broken man who was not apologetic for what he did. He instead just tried to blame the others in the Cambridge ring, saying essentially it was all their fault. They got me into it. I didn't know what I was doing. Gov.
Well, yeah. I think you're right about the ideological side of it. Is that they did genuinely believe that they were doing good for the world in their view.
Absolutely.
But then wouldn't change from that position even when, you know, the actual realities of, you know, the Ukrainian famine and, you know, all the other excesses of Stalin became public knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. It's when the facts changed and their opinions didn't is when you really can start condemning them for what they did. I think that there is little justification once you know what Stalinism is all about in supporting it in any way.
Yeah. You mentioned the friend of yours whose mother had tried to escape from East Germany. Were there any other people who'd lived through the Cold War, who you spoke to directly to try and get some more insight?
Well, I read the memoir of a British journalist called Peter Miller, who was the Sunday Times correspondent in East Berlin during that period, which is quite a fascinating document describing how he went about his job, but the surveillance he was under, how the Stasi attempted to entrap him in a honey trap that as soon as he arrived in East Berlin, he was given a housekeeper who was a sort of young, attractive woman who was clearly sort of available to him, but would have been reporting back on anything he said in his sleep, etc. It's almost comical these days to see the methodologies that the Stasi and their sister services used. It's so blunt and in many ways really quite paranoid that the East Germans were sure that Miller was an MI6 asset, which, well, he claimed he wasn't, and I'm inclined to believe him. But they were just certain that he was because they believed that all Westerners within the Soviet bloc and the Soviet sphere of influence were working for British authorities.
Yeah, I did an interview with Peter Miller a while back, and it was really interesting hearing about that honey trap story as well, but also the surveillance they were under, and reading his file afterwards, and they were trailing his wife to the shops and all sorts of surveillance. So what would you say was the most surprising thing you discovered in your research?
Well, I mentioned, most of us learn a bit about the Soviet era, Soviet bloc at school. One thing that which has always stayed with me during my research is, and it's probably well known to a lot of people who listen to this podcast, the all these delivery vans in East Berlin, which were kind of rolling around the city, which seemed to be kind of delivering groceries and milk, but we really had miniature cells in the back of the van, which unfortunates were bundled into before being taken off for questioning. If I'd ever known about that, I'd forgotten about it, and it really kind of brought home to me that how there is something hiding in plain sight in East Berlin and in East Germany, that these innocuous-looking vans, which you look around any British city or any Western city and you see them all the time and you don't know what's in the back of them. You presume that it's something completely innocent and innocuous, but in East Berlin, it was anything but.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Presumably you've got an elevator pitch for the book. Well, just a couple of sentences as to why people should buy Liberation Square.
Well, it's the elevator pitch is always that it's a thriller set in Soviet-occupied London. And usually that's enough to make people just kind of open their eyes and think, gosh, yeah, that's interesting. I live in London, or I've been to London, or I'm planning to visit London if they're from some other part of the country. Because everyone walks along the streets of London and feels they're familiar. Whereas suddenly, if you say that to them, they suddenly picture the wall down the middle of London, or in the case of my book, it's Checkpoint Charlie is at Piccadilly Circus, and poor old Eros is kind of hemmed in by the wall. So I just can say, well, if you just picture a massive concrete wall running along the side of your house, cutting you off from your neighbors, from your friends, how does that feel?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've always thought that with Berlin and London is you know, just trying to get people's heads around that whole division and the fact that it was a city cut in half on the basis of ideology is just a fascinating subject. And I think of all the Eastern Bloc countries of the Cold War, East Germany is the one that generates the most amount of fascination.
It is because of the division. When you have Russia, you know, 1,000-odd miles away from Britain, it feels quite remote, and it feels like we're not really in conflict with them, or it felt like, or it didn't feel like that so much. But where you are 20 meters away from someone you went to school with, from in some cases from your girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife or mother or son, how extraordinary must that be that you can't see them? If you shouted really loudly, they could just about hear you, but you can't physically see them. Although there is this funny thing that in West Berlin, they had this big viewing platform beside the wall where people could climb up and look down into East Berlin and physically see, you know, their friends or members of their family, could wave to them perhaps. And I wonder a little bit about that, how kind of voyeuristic it must have been to go up on that platform and look down on people who are just much less fortunate than you are. There's this, in the medieval era, there was within Catholic circles, within Catholic thought, there was the idea that one of the pleasures of heaven would be looking down at the souls in hell, burning in hell, that you'd actually enjoy watching everybody else burn, because you just feel quite smug about it. And I often have that at the back of my mind when I think about these people going up onto the platform in West Berlin and looking down on their less fortunate cousins. I imagine very few of them felt smug about it. Most of them probably felt just very distressed about it. But I often have that at the back of my mind.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So with authors I interview, I normally have a few fun questions at the end. You might not think them fun, but anyway, we'll give them a go. But if you were a filmmaker making a film of Liberation Square, who would you cast in the main roles?
I've wondered about that once or twice when I've actually been having meetings about possible adaptation of the book. I'm a little bit kind of lost for who Jane, my female lead, would be. She's 30. She has to go through quite a range of roles. So she starts off fairly weak and ends up very dangerous, frankly. She ends up very ballsy. And so it has to be somebody with a good kind of range of strength to her. Whenever I think about her husband, Nick, I often think about Laurence Olivier, because many people compare my book to Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. In that, Jane is a character rather like the unnamed narrator of Rebecca. In Rebecca, of course, the narrator's new husband's ex-wife ends up dead. She's dead from the beginning. So I think of the film Rebecca, which starred Laurence Olivier as De Winter, the equivalent. He's this brooding, slightly dangerous, very difficult to know character. And I think that's the way I suddenly try to create Nick, that you never really know what he's done, why he's done it, whether he's on the side of the angels or the devils, that he's very ambiguous. And that's very much what I like about him. Whereas with the Jane character, she goes on a journey. You always know what she's about. You know what she's like. It changes very much throughout the book, but you do know her very well. Whereas with this Nick character, I like having him, this slightly ambiguous character that Olivier plays so well.
Right. Okay. That's good. And what piece of music would you have in mind for the soundtrack?
Oh, gosh, that's a very difficult one.
I didn't say they were going to be easy.
Yeah, certainly true. I remember watching Michael Palin on TV many years ago, on one of his travelogues where he went to Russia. It must have been, it was after the fall of the wall. And he encounters the Russian Navy choir singing their anthem. It was the Russian Navy anthem. But I remember that it was this incredibly kind of booming, rumbling presence of a song, which sounded to me like a submarine slipping below water.
Have you ever seen Hunt for Red October?
I have, yes.
I mean, that music I always find is really strong, because although it's a made-up song, it has that great Soviet Cold War effect.
That's right, with Sean Connery doing his famous Russian accent, which happens to be exactly the same as his, his Irish accent.
I think,
accent.
I think Russian accent is a generous description, to be honest.
Yes.
Okay, no, that's great. So if you could invite three personalities from the Cold War period to have a few pints with, who would they be?
Well, the thing is that for that question, that the immediate thought is the one that springs to mind is the monsters. You think of Stalin and Beria, but of course, you know, these are not people you actually want to be in the same room as. I'd be delighted to kind of know something about them, to see them, you know, held behind glass or iron bars, but I wouldn't want to go to local pub with them. I think Churchill is a very interesting figure, and of course he is kind of more connected to the Cold War than we generally associate him with. We associate him with the very hot war of a few years earlier. But he was a very interesting figure during that era, a great campaigner against another breakout of hot war, which would have included nuclear weapons, which, you know, would have really devastated the world beyond compare. I think also, I'm going to go slightly off piece. I'm going to cheat a little bit here. I'd be fascinated to meet Sidney Reilly, Ace of Spies, who, although it wasn't technically Cold War, who was very much involved in the war, the espionage war between the West and Soviet Russia in the early period. He was executed, of course, by the Soviets in 25, as I remember. But for those who don't know, Sidney Reilly, born Sigmund Rosenfeld, as I remember, in Russia or Odessa. It's difficult to know because he kept changing the story. He changed about 10 different times. Sidney Reilly was one of the models, possibly the most important model for James Bond. He was an extraordinary man. He was essentially a freelance spy for 30 odd years. Worked primarily for Britain, but also for lots of other great powers, around the turn of the 20th century, up until he was executed by the Soviets.
Yeah, I only really know of him from that Sam Neill TV series, but he certainly sounds like a colourful character. So the other two.
Well, I'm going to go with Churchill. Who else? I think I would probably then pick as a third option somebody who no one's ever heard of, including me. I think somebody who just lived behind the Iron Curtain, lived in Berlin during that period, who can tell me about, you know, the daily life and daily struggles, because we learn so much about the intergovernmental plays. We don't really hear so much about what it's like to not have enough food on the table for your family in the mornings. Mm.
So was that three?
That makes
sense. That was your three. Yeah, sorry, I'd lost count. We went into so much detail with Sidney Reilly.
Yeah,
I lost count.
Well, he's a fascinating man.
Yeah. And do you have any idea you mentioned some of the questions you'd ask them, but I mean, say Churchill, what would you be asking him that you feel we don't necessarily know?
Gosh. I think that when you're interviewing people as research, I think usually the most fascinating question is, what have you never told anyone? What have you never revealed about yourself or what you're involved with? What is the most shocking thing that you were told by one of your intelligence operatives?
Yeah. Almost the same questions I ask you.
Yes, a little bit.
So where can people find you online if they want to converse?
Well, I'm on Twitter as Gareth Rubin. That's GARETHRUBIN. I also have a website, just GarethRubin.com. You can keep up with what books I'm publishing. And I still work as a journalist. You can keep up with what articles I'm writing, some about my book, some about just more general social affairs.
Great. Well, I will be providing links to those accounts and Gareth's website in the show notes. Gareth, thank you very much for coming on Cold War Conversations. It's been really interesting.
It has indeed.
Well, that's it for today's episode. However, there's photos of us at Karl Marx's grave and links to the book in the show notes, which are at coldwarconversations.com/episode and the number 66. Don't forget, you can support us and get a Cold War Conversations coaster at patreon.com/coldwarpod. And if you like what you're hearing in the podcast, you can also help us by leaving reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, our Facebook page, or with your favorite podcast provider. It really helps raise our profile and get new guests on the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, then do visit our vibrant Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners just like you are continuing the Cold War conversation. Just search Cold War Conversations on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at Cold War Pod and Instagram at Cold War Conversations. So it's freebie time, and a lucky listener will win a copy of Liberation Square. Just join our mailing list at coldwarconversations.com and email me at ian@coldwarpod.com with the email title Liberation Square, and you will go into the draw that will be made at the end of June. I will email the winner directly for delivery details. Good luck to everybody who enters. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye.
Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.